You're listening to Drinking on the Job, DOTJ. I'm your host, John Coyle. Drinking on the Job is a toast to the culture of food, wine, and all things fermented. We'll be talking with winemakers, musicians, artists, late-night bartenders, scoundrels, and more. It's time to grab a glass before its last call.
Sabato Sagaria has hospitality in his blood from being director of food and beverage at the Little Nell, chief restaurant officer at the Union Square Hospitality, and co-founder of Après Cru Hospitality, which manages a few of my favorite restaurants. And if that's not enough, he's also a master sommelier. What a great day for DOTJ Podcast. We have Sabato Sagaria. I hope I'm not killing his name. He is a hospitality, I would say hospitality king. I really love to discuss hospitality the voices I hear a lot of times, it's waning. And obviously because of a deficit of employment and people who left New York. But he's here to talk about that. But I met him at the Somme film, Cup of Salvation. A brilliant film. It's about a father and daughter trying to revive an ancient grape in the homeland of Armenia. It's a political thriller. They were doing this vineyard during war, and Sabato was on the panel afterwards. And I gotta say, you have to see the movie, Cup of Salvation. You have to see it. My wife is not a wine geek, and she was like, oh my God, that was so good. But I'm gonna start with, you said, I'm gonna butcher it probably, but you said, my father came to America the first time. He bought a pair of shoes to come to America. Mm-hmm. And like the bells just went off in my head. And I thought, man, that is such a beautiful thought that he came here and bought his first pair of shoes, mm-hmm, and lands in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So just give me a little bit, like, see around now. How incredibly proud he must be of you. Like, what was that like?
So to give some context, the movie... it's about the father, the daughter, and it's about restoring or making wine in Iran, and how there had been decades of people that had been grown up in Iran and been deprived of that. And
right, yeah.
There's a winemaker that went to Oregon because he couldn't make wine in Iran, and making wine there, and showing how the next generation always wants to their next generation to do better. And it really hit home to me because I'd seen the movie, but I hadn't seen the final cut.
Right.
And it hit me that much more watching it on the big screen and seeing that. And as I kind of held up the mirror and my dad coming to the United States when he was 7, he grew up outside of Salerno in his tiny little village. And he was a shepherd and he never had shoes while he was there, and climbing the hills. And he got his first pair of shoes for the boat ride over. And he wore them out on the boat ride because he'd never walked upstairs in shoes.
Yeah, that's and crazy.
So hearing that, and then he was the first in his family to graduate from high school, go to college, got his PhD, and he's still around, and really grateful for that. And, the outlook that he has is, hey, I've gotten this far, and I'd be disappointed if you only got this far, so take it even farther. And that, so...
So he went from being a shepherd with no shoes to getting a PhD.
Yeah.
Like, the...
psychology and statistics is what he taught.
Fuck.
Yeah, right?
It stopped me in the movie when you said it and when you were talking to the panel. And I was like, oh my God. And my wife leans over and goes, you got to have this guy on your podcast. And I was still blown away. That is incredible. Yeah. Particularly in the period of darkness we are right now with immigration, mm-hmm, and we're overwhelmed by it and we're seeing, sadness about this. We have to remind each other what this country is built on. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's not a problem, but our lifeblood has always been immigration. And that story, and so did you feel the pressure now of like, if I could do this? I mean, he must be pretty proud of you.
It was interesting. I think, I studied hotel restaurant management and I got into the restaurant business and then wine. And, I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, so there weren't sommeliers there. The only wine that he really knew of was the wine that his family would make and we'd have on holidays. And I'll say wine in quotations because okay, after I tasted it, definitely does not taste like wine. Probably more like tang fermented underneath the radiator.
Right. It's got alcohol.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. He didn't understand. He wanted me to go to business school and I applied to business school. I didn't get in and I went on to take the master sommelier exam. And they're like, okay, that's great. that's good for you, but not really understand the context. And I actually surprised him in Denver, where my sister lives, when we did a Psalm 1 premiere. And that follows myself and some close friends through the MS process.
Right.
And I think he saw that, and it really brought into focus for him, or gave him a better understanding of what that meant in the wine world.
Sure.
And saying, okay, that is your business school. That is your PhD. And not that I needed that movie to help give context to it, or, right, or acceptance, but I think it really showed him, oh, that is a pretty big deal, and I understand why you've been pouring all this time, energy, and effort into that over the past 10 years. So
yeah. And, wine is, it's liquid art.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. And I'm sure you started to appreciate that when it's really, because that show is so beautiful. But, a PhD is, or a business school, it took you 10 years to get your MS.
Mm-hmm.
For people listening, they've seen or listened to in past episodes the journey to get your master sommelier, but it is an incredible, arduous task. So where did the fire in the belly come from to, like, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it?
Yeah, so when I first sort of got into wine professionally, I was at the Greenbrier in West Virginia. And so you can imagine the sommelier community in the mid-90s in West Virginia was maybe population of 2-3, maybe. I don't know if there were others out there, or how many people could pronounce the word sommelier. And so I was doing a lot of studying on my own, and then heard about this thing called the Court, and would read anything I could, because there wasn't much of a restaurant culture there. So for me, the starting with the Court was kind of a chance for me to hold up a mirror and say, okay, how am I doing? Or what else can I learn, and how can I better develop myself? And so I went all the way through the advanced while I was in West Virginia, and basically studying by myself. And so then that was a chance for me to check in and see, okay, how am I doing out there versus other people, but am I progressing, or what else can I do to develop myself?
And back then it was flashcards and you had nobody around you. Now there's like software programs, there's a community built around it.
100%.
So you would definitely be in West Virginia, although Greenbrier was pretty known for having a great wine list.
Yes,
still you're in the boonies.
Exactly.
Really.
Yeah. And so there wasn't like a restaurant community or peers that were in there. So there's myself, and then we had wine captains. And the way at that time, it was a union hotel, and you would have to become wine captain was the highest position in the hotel, or in the food and beverage hourly staff. And so you had captains, and then I guess probably in the 80s, people started drinking wine. And they're like, oh, we need to promote people to be wine captains. And so the people with the most seniority were the captains. And so they got promoted. But a lot of them didn't drink. And I remember doing my first, wine tasting for the 20 wine captains. And I'm this 23-year-old kid and all excited to tell them everything I know and that. And I pour the wines and I see half of them aren't drinking. And they're like, oh, I don't drink anymore. I'm a recovering alcoholic. Great. You can smell if you want.
Yeah.
There's some guy in the back room, I think it's probably 70s, arms crossed. Like, only thing I'm drinking is Jack Daniels. I'm like, okay, it's going to be one of those classes. But
I have to tell you my funny story about doing a wine class. I was at Café des Artistes, mm-hmm. and the wine director said, I was coming in to do a wine class. And the wine director warned me. He goes, these are some crusty union guys who are like, you're going to be tough. I said, and I used to perform and do comedy. And so I was like, I got this. Don't worry about it. So first thing, we're tasting Sauvignon Blanc. And I'm like, hey, this. And I go, what's it taste like? And this one guy just, he goes, yeah, this tastes like piss. And I stopped and I went, sir, if there's anyone that would know what urine in your mouth would be, it probably would be you. Everybody went, oh, shit. That was the last grenade they threw at me, because they're like, fuck.
Yeah. But what I then realized that was going to be a tough crowd to crack if we kept on playing with those odds. So I, 20 on one. So I opened it up to anybody, front of house, back of house, that wanted to show up. And then you started to see this new generation of people that really wanted to be there.
Sure.
It was mandatory for those folks, but everyone else was showing up there because they wanted to. And that's what was exciting. And that gave me hope that, wow, I can inject this spark and energy into others, and that can shift the tide. And so it was really great to see over my tenure there, those people that were, and this is how dated it was, your entry-level position in the dining room was either as a busboy or a roll girl. And you can think of the genders associated with those.
Oh, wow.
So you had those busboys and roll girls that were showing up, their first job in the hospitality industry. And like, wow, maybe this can be a way for me to open up growth in the future. And seeing them get excited is I kind of saw what unlocked wine for me. And so that's what got me out of bed every day to do that.
I think community is key to learning. I mean, you know, primal days, we sat around the fire, we exchanged information. It reminds me when I'm doing a tasting with a bunch of people, I still taste with Tieber, we bring in wines, we're tasting, or I go to tasting or sit in on blind tasting purposely so that I can continue to also hear what other people have to say so that, you know, your just mind expands, your palate expands while you're doing that. So what's the move from there into your next market? Because your, like, resume is fucking insane, dude.
Thank you. Well, I went from West Virginia to the end of Little Washington, went over the hills, literally 2 hours. So I think the population was 350, and maybe it's 351 because there was a woman that was pregnant when I left town. So,
but it was not yours.
No, not mine.
Okay,
not mine.
All right, yes.
Good. Thanks for clarifying that. But actually at the inn, I was actually burnt out on wine, and I went there because I wanted to get back into it. But after being there, it was almost every day was the same, and the only way it differed was the bottles I popped, and it wasn't as, I was like, okay, maybe I step out of wine. And, you know, I was at this kind of crossroads, and I went to Aspen, because, of course, John Denver sang about every other town that I'd lived in, so why not head to the Rocky Mountains?
Yeah, of course.
And so I went to Aspen because there was a great wine community there. It was a 5-star hotel at the Little Nell, and being able to be a food and beverage director there, I was able to still be involved with wine. That's when Richard Betts was the wine director there.
So were you offered the job or you went?
I was offered the job. So
okay,
I left
great.
The inn. I was the wine director there and went to Aspen. And at that point, Aspen was the largest town post-college that I lived in before I came to New York. So that kind of shows you the small little communities there.
Right. Yeah.
But while I was in Aspen, that's when, you know, Richard was there. Jonathan Pulis was the wine director or was underneath him there, who went on to get his MS as well. Jay Fletcher was in, was the, I think the chair of the quartermaster sommeliers at that time. And what I saw is like people were studying for the MS exam. It did have a sense of community, and that's something I had never had before.
Yeah.
And so it almost became like CrossFit for people that wanted to get into the wine business.
Good way of putting it.
And, you know, Aspen's like that on a lot of fronts. So I remember there, I didn't mountain bike and going mountain biking. People are better than me at altitude to push me to do better on the mountains, skiing or snowboarding with people that are better than me, put me on trails that I wouldn't have gone on by myself. And wine was the same way. And so taking that mindset to it, and it was really great to be around that. And I think Jay was what got helped me get back into wanting to do that.
Yeah. And it was almost like boot camp for a lot of like people on the MS track. They would go. I know Laura Manick. I know a bunch of people went there and studied with Richard to get kind of like insider information, you know, or you know, perfect their.
I think Richard and I worked together for a year, but then I was in Aspen for 6 years, and over that 6 years, we had five people that had worked at the Nell go on to pass, and so it was really that's when I think Jonathan, Carlton, Dustin, Brian McClintock, myself. All were kind of there around that time. So as somebody was training, everyone would kind of work around them to get ready for that exam and also bettering themselves with it as well. So it was really an exciting culture.
I'm going to take 1 second, just drink this wine, Rico Nuevo Albillar. It's Albillo. I want to thank Nacho for bringing it in for T. Edward. He said, it's in Gredo, so super, super high elevation. Albillo is a grape you don't see much of. I thought if I'm going to sit here with my man who's a master sommelier, I got to throw a little something, a little curveball at him. But you know, they're usually
thanks for not blinding me out, by the way.
Right. That would have been fucking. That would have been torch. That wouldn't have been fair at all. Right. That would be like, you know, I have a running joke with my good buddies. He went to China and brought back wine. I go, can you bring in the office? Let's pretend we're blind. I'll say that tastes like something I had in China 10 years ago. But yeah, no, it's a super super fun wine. But getting back to the MS thing. What, like, still kudos for you for, because a lot of people get an MS and some people do great things with it. And other people, it's just, you know, they're working for a wine importer and nothing wrong with that. But like you combined the best of your wine knowledge and then segued into business, which we'll talk about because that is where your resume looks like it was built. Like you took your incredible wine, your MS and then, got together and started doing restaurant management, which we'll get to your consulting company at the end. But so it's a great thing. Do you still hold are you still part of the court system and actively involved?
I was on the board for I think 2 years. I love the teaching element of it. That's, you know, both my parents are professors, and I look at the folks that have invested in my career along the way in giving that time and mentorship, and if that's the way that I can give back, and also not just in the wine side of things, but also to show that there's other avenues. And I remember when I was coming up, and they were like, hey, you're a master sommelier, now what do you do? You know, work on the floor, you're going to sell wine. Like, there weren't many avenues. And now as I look at out there in terms of what avenues exist or opportunities exist for people that obtain their MS diploma, it's not just the pinnacle of your career. It's one of the great accomplishments on your way throughout your career and build on that. So I think if it can show people that there's a new way or new opportunities out there, I think that's exciting.
What's the first thing you drank after you got your MS when you knew you passed? Besides everything.
Oh, I think I did a shot of VEP chartreuse with Carlton and Jay at the Nell. Yeah.
It is kind of crazy how this you're a very tight organization, the MS crew, which I think is great because I think they took a little hit a while ago and kind of blew through it. Mia Vandewaard's on the board now, who I really love. Kudos to her for passing twice, basically, right? Yeah. So then you go from Little Nell to is the calling to New York, or again, somebody offered you something to come here?
So I've been in Aspen for 6 years, and Aspen's an amazing place, but it's also like Never Never Land meets Groundhog Day in some way, and it's at some point was saying, okay, what next? And not really knowing what to do. I had my MS, but I was a food and beverage director and, you know, wanting to continue to, I think what I saw was that I could still be involved in wine, but I think hospitality and the business of restaurants was really exciting to me. And I wanted to be kind of as comfortable at a dining room table or at a boardroom table as I was at a dining room table and wanting to understand that element of it. So when I was in Aspen, I got to know Danny Meyer very well. He would stay with us every year during Aspen Food and Wine. And I ran into him at Pebble Beach Food and Wine Festival and grabbed a coffee. And he said, hey, I'm creating this job called Chief Restaurant Officer. You know, would you like to come to New York and do that? And until that point, New York had never been on my radar.
Sure.
But when Danny says that, you're like, oh, let's
Mr.
Let's
Hospitality.
Stop.
Yeah. Okay.
So
yeah.
That's what drew me from Aspen to New York City. And I was Chief Restaurant Officer at USHG for 4 years.
Was Mylino open at that point?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's crazy because they have like, I forget, I'm drawing a blank on John's name, but there's a
Reagan.
Just John Reagan is yourself. And there was one other MS that was there as well, I think, right?
So, yeah. So when I started, John was, he was, I think, the director of beverage. And then he became sort of my right hand on operations, and now I think he's vice president of restaurants there. But again, John, I think, is someone that's great, that understands wine, understands business, understands hospitality as a whole. And while we were working together, I think we had I think there were five MSs that end up working at USHG with us over that time.
It's crazy.
It was great to see. And again, it's seeing what those people have also been able to go on and do with it. You know, Mia, Jack, Kyung Moon, Michael Engelman, like there's a number of great.
Oh, I forgot Michael went to the Modern, right? Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And then, so what's the day to day of like chief restaurant opera? Like, what is that? It sounds fantastic. So, are you pouring through like every morning you look at P&L sheets, how many covers, you know, beverage sales, food cost? What does that like look like for you?
Yeah, it was a three-ring circus, and we had 8 restaurants when I started and I think 17 when I left, and it's all elements of that. So it's sort of obviously the culture piece is a big thing and looking at, you know, trying to help think more strategically on and leverage best practices around the company and look at all aspects of the business. And I also oversaw marketing, operations, and purchasing as well. So there's a lot of...
And did you love doing that?
Yeah. It was, again, it was like the three-ring circus. It's all the elements that come together to really create an amazing experience for guests. And then we also said, okay, how can we also expand that or connect with guests beyond the four walls? And that's where working with marketing and things like that was really fun to do that.
Shake Shack open right at the start of that? Or
Shake Shack... had been opened, and actually I went to school with Randy. He was in my class, the CEO of Shake Shack, and he did Shake Shack, so I did the full-service restaurants, and we had Union Square Events. But Shake Shack was part of the family, and then they kind of separated while we were together and went on to do great great things as well.
Yeah. Shake Shack's printing money. Danny's like, yeah, enough with the fucking white tablecloths.
burgers are good.
Burgers and fries. Mm-hmm. Way to go. So what tempts you to leave there? Or is this the pandemic drives this next move? Or?
No, so after that, it was an amazing opportunity and one of, a dream job. And all the restaurants I was running were different concepts and they were all within New York. And so when I looked at saying, what's the next challenge? When it was like, I saw, what is it like to grow and scale one concept and what is that to do beyond there? And so it's like, how do you not only scale a business, but also scale a culture, scale hospitality? And I joined a company called Bar Taco out of Connecticut. And we had 13 restaurants then. And people like, oh, you went to go work for a taco restaurant. And I remember walking in the first Bar Taco and ordered a margarita and they grabbed the lime and juiced it by hand in front of me. And you looked up and saw the tequilas and mezcals and like, wow. There's no Patron or Jose Cuervo. Like everything was very thoughtfully curated. It's like something's different here. And so was able to be a part of that organization as the president and help them grow into that for 2 years.
And so you found that really exciting. Mm-hmm. I've often talked about, and I've had a few distillers on, mezcal for me is like my drug of choice. Mm-hmm. I just love mezcal. So I would have loved just tasting through their mezcals. I just did a flight with a very good friend, Kent. He walked me through 15 different agaves and just because he knew I loved it. He's, hey, I'm going to do a quick little masterclass on this if you want to sit in. I'm like, are you kidding me? Of course I want to sit in. And just, it was mind blowing.
Likewise. I mean,
still my fave.
I say Tepestate is my spirit animal.
Tepestate, yes. Yeah. That was one of my faves.
It's,
yeah.
I think when I started learning more about mezcal, a lot of similarities with wine and grapes and like the nuances of it. And to think that these agaves are growing in the wild for 20 years and then they get harvested by hand and like, and how that nobody's poaching it, like amazing to think about it. And then you go, we took a trip with our teams down to Mexico. We took them to Jalisco. It's like, oh, a lot of them have never been in distilleries. Like, oh, big shiny tanks. It's amazing. And then like, okay, let's go to Oaxaca. And then it's like, oh.
Little palanks.
Yeah, we've got a pickup truck rusting up on blocks. There's a three-legged dog, and then they're fermenting this in their above-ground pool. And a guy that can blow in a spoon, and he can tell you the alcohol of that agave by the bubbles. Like,
yeah, it's crazy.
Totally different.
There's no tubes. They're using the reeds that are by the property. No. I also just like, and it, I always think it's like the last kind of craft spirit for me because. Yeah. And it's in the wheelhouse. And so then from there, because obviously now with that resume, your phone is ringing anyway. So there, what happens? You come back to New York?
Yeah. So I was still living in New York, and then I was commuting back and forth to Dallas because we got purchased by Del Frisco's restaurant group. And so for after 2 years of opening 9 restaurants and getting purchased twice and integrations and unwinding all that, I was like, let's take a step back. So I was on sabbatical when COVID hit and was in a fortunate position where didn't have to make the tough decisions a lot of folks in our industry had to make about what restaurants to close or, who I have to lay off. I was trying to see where the opportunity was kind of once we got on the other side of this. And I think like a lot of us did held up the mirror and said, okay, what do you enjoy doing or what am I looking for next? And I love to grow things, whether that's people, cultures, concepts, businesses, and through that also growing myself and started Apres Crew, which is our company now. It's been a lot of fun to help other restaurateurs that I've admired throughout my career kind of really the 1+1=3 and how we can help them grow and do more than they could do on their own.
Right. My joke to myself was, how many MSs does it take to open a hospitality group? And apparently just 3 of you, right?
Or two of us.
It's Apres Crew. By the way, I love, I've talked extensively about Mark Forgione. I've had him on. It's one of my favorite restaurants in the city. One-fifth I love. I mean, they're just amazing restaurants. So when somebody brings you on, you look at everything top to bottom, try to increase their GP, get their hospitality better. Hospitality is one of those things like you're not aware of it until it's bad, right? Because I've always said, I was in a restaurant in Brooklyn, and I was like, I could feel like the my wait is not happy, the bartender's pissed off, I'm watching it was open kitchen, and everyone miserable, and my wife's like, there's nobody happy here. You could feel it, and I think that's what real hospitality is be able to empower these people so they're happy. They feel like they're in the right place. They feel like they're working for someone great and doing something great. And I get that at those restaurants, whether it's Kyle or Grace or Emily or like whoever, like the crew that work in your restaurants. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what a good hospitality group does. Mm-hmm. Anyone can come in and kind of just look at numbers and help you get a better GP, probably. Mm-hmm. As we know, there's lots of restaurants that are successful, and they have no idea why they're successful. Mm-hmm. They're printing money. They could make a lot more money, mm-hmm. but they don't have infrastructure like you guys mm-hmm. bring in to a group, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we actually invest in and partner with all five of our partnerships. And with it, it's for us very important to understand understand the history of it, appreciate the past, understand how we got to where we are, and then understand that culture and say, okay, how do we help grow that culture? And as you look to grow a business, it's how you grow the culture, how you grow the people. And through that time, as we look to start working with them, it's really exciting to see sort of how they have advanced and how they have grown. But also we were drawn to them in the first place because they did have great hospitality. They have great soul to all of the restaurants, and to be able to help understand that and preserve that through growth, I think is really an exciting opportunity.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Let me know your thoughts on this. Digital menus, the QR codes, still drive me insane. I was at one of my favorite restaurants, Evelina in Brooklyn on Lafayette, and the food, the service there is great. I still hate the QR code because I think, like, if somebody's not looking at the menu, I look down the bar, look at tables, and everybody's on their phone anyway. And I always think, do we need one more reason to be on our phone? And I get why we did it during COVID. But we're tactile. We're dancing animals. We need touch. We need and I think I would love to see that go away. There's too many restaurants that have it. And I get saving paper. I get all that.
I view QR codes were like on the ropes. They were on the verge of extinction. And then COVID came. It was like, QR codes are back. And I think they served a purpose during that time. Mm-hmm. But I'm with you. And I think even seeing, like, I remember going out to dinner with my mom and it was on a QR code. And, you know, my mom's not tech savvy, but she's not like, she just struggled with that or like that element. And I think looking at a short menu is one thing, but looking at a wine list is a nightmare for me and trying to look at it and say, oh, like what kind of font it is. You're trying to zoom in and have to look across three screens. And again, to your point, you know, having dinner across from my partner and she's like, why are you texting? I'm not. I'm like, I'm trying to order a glass of wine.
Right. Like, and you're probably like me. Like I'd go to a restaurant. If I go to dinner with my wife, I go before because I want to look at the wines. Cause otherwise she's like, will you quit looking at the wine list?
The wine list widow.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. But you know, and then they give you the iPad and it's even worse. And to your point, exactly. Think about this. You're with your mom and all of a sudden you're in a restaurant. You're having a great time. You haven't seen her in a while. You sit down. She has to hit the QR code and now she feels stupid. She can't see. And you're like, is this really the way I want to start the dinner off with this person I love, that mm-hmm. I want to be with, that I want to break bread with? Yeah. And that's what kills me about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, hopefully you're preaching that to her. But you don't have QR codes.
We don't. I think we've done them some for like special menus or kind of quote unquote secret menus mm-hmm. and that we'd have like specials that we have that are on there for like bottles of wine. But I don't think we have any of our restaurants right now.
Let me ask you about the micro trend. NFT restaurants. What do you think of the whole crypto private club? I see it more in New York. And I used to, 10 years ago, I said, you know, New York eventually will just be this island of incredibly wealthy people and every bit else we trained in and bussed in to provide service. And I feel like it's getting there, particularly when you see like Blackbird or NFT mm-hmm. and you're like, they're so exclusive or, you know, Bond or, you know, where it's just membership mm-hmm. only. And I'm thinking, I don't know. But the NFT thing really weirds me out.
I'm not as familiar with it. And I kind of feel analog when mm-hmm. I hear of it, but I haven't encountered some of it. And I think there are maybe some people and that it applies to. And, you know, for me, as I thought about, whether it be private clubs, et cetera, and there's an element of that that I can see really, that'd be great. But I also am one of those people that likes new experiences, new discoveries in a town like New York. When you have so many amazing restaurants and new restaurants opening, I want to go experience those. And so it's hard for me to go back to, you know, want to try something new. And there's a couple of restaurants that I'll go back to because it is that warm hug that you get.
But, oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
And that's, I think, what a club does for some folks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I also think there's just to just to be honest, mm-hmm. as people who want to live in a gated community, a sure. culinary gated community, yes. where it's just like, I just want to be around my folks. Yeah. You know, my people who have their yachts in there. And that's cool, too. Yeah. They have their club. Yeah.
And they drink wine there, too.
And they drink wine. Yeah. They're buying wine from yeah. us.
There you go.
I'm super happy about that. What excites you coming up in the wine world? Is there any, I mean, yeah, obviously, you know, like the way Orange took, mm-hmm. is like NA has taken a huge market share now.
I think that's something, you mentioned that, I was just having a conversation with someone, like, I don't think there's been a better time to drink non-alcoholic than there is right now. Mm-hmm. And I love wine, but also there's some, I don't want to drink every night. And I'd say, you know, for beer, I'm just like, I want a cold Corona and that's kind of my jam. And yeah. I'm not an IPA kind of guy, but I found myself buying like 6-pack of non-alcoholic beer. Hitachino Nest is one of my favorite breweries out of Japan, and
oh
they make a ginger yuzu ginger ale. And so Japanese grocery store opened up and I bought like 6 different beers of theirs, not knowing that this one was a non-alcoholic. And then I tasted this and like, holy shit, this is delicious. And experimented with a couple others and it's like delicious on like a school night, you know.
Yeah, I do the same. I went out with a restaurant pro, I won't name who, and you know, I'm kind of like the NA thing works because I keep telling people it's not about total denial. It's mm-hmm. not about sobriety. It's about a balance. Mm-hmm. And it's a school night. You go out, you're meeting somebody. I've had like Athletic Brewing and mm-hmm. somebody, hey, what are you drinking? I'm just having a beer. Mm-hmm. Oh, pour me one. Great. And I'm waiting for them to go, what is this? And they're like, they just thought they had 2 beers.
Yeah.
We actually had 2 non-alcoholic yeah. beers, sat down, had a bottle of wine. So we had 2 glasses of wine, yeah. both woke up feeling great, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that's what it's really about is mm-hmm. this kind of balance. Guinness has a 00 mm-hmm. that, you
I've
know,
that,
I'm
yeah.
Irish. I'm just like, this is a joke.
Uh-huh.
And I went out and had it and I was like, oh my God, the guy from Monk McGinn's,
that,
Irish,
yeah.
and he was just like, it's a huge hit in Ireland.
Yeah.
It's, and again, it's like, he runs a sports bar. He's like, if you're here for 3 hours watching a game, you're drinking 2-3 non, and mm-hmm. then 2 regular, you
yeah.
go
so
out.
Use it as a speed bump. Like, I'll have a Negroni, and then a phony Negroni, and then like, great, and then I can
yeah.
kind of just slow things down, and then get back on the train if you need to.
Yeah, I'm like, Grower Champagne has hit a new high,
mm-hmm.
I see, which I'm very happy mm-hmm. about. I love, you know, supporting small growers mm-hmm. and everything there qualitatively wise. And Pinot Meunier seems mm-hmm. to be having its wonderful heyday mm-hmm. in Champagne, which is fantastic. But you see anything else coming down the pike? I mean, we're both in this. The NA thing is the only I can see peeking around the corner.
Yeah, just,
that's going
to
get
bigger.
I think
there's more open-mindedness to trying things. And
exactly, yeah.
I think while we don't have to go down this rabbit hole, but I'm not persons like, hey, you know, I'm not dogmatic about natural wine or, you know, mm-hmm. like, oh, love this. But I also find myself going to restaurants that have like a full natural wine list where I may not know a lot of the producers, but it's also a chance for me to try something new or different region and things yeah. like that. So it's also, from my standpoint, opens me up to some new things. But I think there is a lot more opportunity to drink well in any segment or yeah. also experiment yeah. to try new things.
Well, I think you know, you've done some blind tasting stuff on YouTube mm-hmm. and with Somme TV. And I think this all the time because, you know, I'm not a kid anymore. I've been doing this for a long time.
You can get your fake ID if you want. Yeah.
I think the grays will cover it or the invisibles. And I think that I always approach trying new stuff with a very, very open mind because I know guys who are – or women who are like late 30s, 40s, oh, I fucking hate natural wine. And I'm like, why has this become political? But, you know – Dresdner had a killer Italian mm-hmm. Italy's been making great Italian wine. It's just that name turns mm-hmm. people off, whatever. But I do the same thing. This isn't basically a natural mm-hmm. wine
yeah.
that we're drinking, and it's fucking delicious.
Yeah.
Like I prefer just to drink something and have my own opinion.
Mm-hmm. And that's why yeah. when I was at the inn and I was wine buying, every time we'd taste with a distributor, we taste blind because first of all, I want to know what's in the glass. Is it delicious? And yeah. if I can kind of guess what is ballpark, then I know that okay, it's. There's typicity there. And then if it was cheaper than I thought or, you know, that price, like, okay, maybe it punches over its weight class and check those boxes, go on the list rather than looking at a label and saying, oh, or a style. And they go, I don't drink any of that. And,
yeah, totally. Yeah. What's the connection to Somme TV? I know they have, it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's, I don't think there's nothing like it mm-hmm. personally. I mean, I think it's $50 for a year. Mm-hmm. It covers, it's a travelogue, it's mm-hmm. culinary, it's tons of great wines, blind tasting tips, all that stuff. What is your connection to that?
I just knew Jason yeah. from when we did the first Somme movie and
yeah.
known him over the years. And again, it's like when I was studying, it's like, great, you'd read books that were, you know, out of date in terms of some of the material that's in there, and magazines and you know, websites. But to me, it's another another way of engaging with wine education, and that's entertaining as well. And so, you know, whenever I have a chance to do something, and it's also fun for me to do some of those blind tastings. I don't get to do that enough, and like to do that. And I always found, like, when we would taste with Jay and Aspen, he'd blind taste us, and then we'd bring two wines for him to blind taste. And seeing him work through those wines also helped me. And I remember there was like three of us that were studying for the exam, and I think we all probably brought Pinot Grigio and Albarino to him back to back to back. He's like, "What's with you guys?" Because we were struggling with it. And then,
Hey,
how does you
that's
know?
That's a tough one.
Yeah, Obi-Wan taste through this and can watch it happen.
So. Yeah, for sure. Well, we are at the part of the show where you have a dream and God speaks to you and he says, "Sabato, you've been so kind and generous with your knowledge and making people feel fantastic. I'm going to give you a gift, and it will be, I'm going to let you know the last day you're going to be on the planet. So plan it accordingly, what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, what you're going to listen to."
Okay.
What are you eating?
What am I eating? Well, first of all, my toes are in the sand somewhere.
Nice.
So what am I eating? I'm eating seafood and... I think about some of the seafood I had in the south of Spain, and little fish just grilled, could be some lobsters grilled, and probably drinking some delicious Ravano Chablis probably to go with that. That's probably where I'm feeling the toes in the sand. And I'm probably just listening to the ocean, you know.
Right on.
I mean, there's a lot of other stuff I'd like to listen to, but I don't know if that's kind of the genre. I'm not. It's not like the walk-on song. That's a little bit kind of different than this time.
So I want people to be able to find you. Mm-hmm. So could you give us your IG or the Après Cru website?
Sabato 3, S-A-B-A-T-O 3. I'm the third. So that's on, I guess, the social channels. And then our company is Après Cru, A-P-R-E-S. CRU.com and has all of our restaurants on there and our partnerships and kind of who we are.
Cool. And those are some of my favorite restaurants. So go on the site, check it out, and DM me if you disagree, but you won't. Thanks for coming on, Sabato.
Thank you, John.
I appreciate it.
This is great.
Cool.
Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to check us out at dotjpodcast.com. Until then, I'll see you at the bar.